Every single thing about the episode is garbage. Garbage. Ugh.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, where we experience science from the perspective of lab rats. I am Glenn Butler, and I'm not sure how much I've actually said this on the show before, but when inviting people on the podcast, I've often thought of it as bringing them into the podcast Mind Palace, a metaphor that obviously didn't originate with the series Sherlock, but probably entered a lot of people's vocabularies because of it. And after the latest series, though, I'm not sure I want to keep using that particular line. But of course, what may or may not have been spoiled for us now is something we'll get into in a little bit. And we will have spoilers for the whole series, but especially Series 4, the most recently aired episodes. Now, of course, I have the great pleasure of welcoming back to the podcast someone who's been kind enough to come on several times before, and someone whom I know has thoughts and feelings aplenty about Sherlock, Alana Kelly. Alana, would it be fair to say the show's accrued some emotional context?
Has accrued some emotional context? There's a phrase for you. Yes, it has accrued some emotional context. Maybe several. What's the plural of context? Is it contexts?
Just plain old contexts, I think.
Okay.
got to work the diction on that one.
Nice.
I always like to work the diction. So we're talking about Series 4 coming a year after a one-off special that we discussed a little bit at the time, which came 2 years after the last series. This is a show that comes along, you know, every geologic era or so.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about the special from last year a little bit on our Force Awakens episode, and we were both generally pretty positive about it, but not really loving it entirely. So did that color how you were kind of anticipating Series 4? Were you looking forward to it? How were you feeling coming in?
I look forward to Sherlock. I'm definitely a Benedict Cumberbatch super fan, so I like to watch his work. And then I came to also really love Martin Freeman's Watson. So I was like, great, any chance to see them, I will look forward. And so I was definitely happy to think about a season four. Yes.
Yeah, I generally agree. I think the show is a sort of, it's really fun at times when it's at its best. You know, it kind of brings you along on this kind of energetic ride of figuring things out with Sherlock to an extent. The direction and editing, the way they kind of display clues and display data on screen, the text displayed on screen, which is a trademark of the show, kind of brings you along with it and in a really engaging way. And that's kind of a treat that comes along every now and then, is the way that I've generally thought about it. But
yes.
But
it's what we enjoy a lot about things that come out of the BBC in general. Like, the production values are usually quite high. Sorry, and they have been so much for this show. That's the other thing. Like, it's usually a visual treat. It's often like a writing treat, like a narrative treat. There's often some really killer dialogue. And yeah, I feel like a strange need to organize what we're going to talk about. So there's three episodes. There's the Six Thatchers, which is episode 4-1. Then we have the Lying Detective, which is 4-2. And the Final Problem, which is 4-3.
Yes, indeed. If we're heading into the series, and especially the Six Thatchers, the first episode, we have to talk about fridging Mary Watson, don't we?
Oh, yeah, but I wouldn't call it a fridge.
Really?
At this point. No, she was around the entire previous season. She has her own character. Like, there's a lot of arguments to be made about how Mary is developed / underdeveloped / weirdly developed, and those are fine, deep discussions to have. But I think at the point in which we lose her, spoiler alert, she dies, I wouldn't call it a fridge. Because, like, yes, like, when we fridge somebody, we're doing it to motivate somebody else, and sure, that's part of it, but, like, often the character has no other features or narrative value, and I don't think that's true of Mary. I think she has other stuff going on, enough other stuff to not call it a fridge.
She definitely has more to her in Series 3, mm-hmm. and she was one of the greatest parts of that series. She was a fantastic addition to the show. And I'm really quite put out that she was removed.
And she, but I knew her. I knew her time was limited. As soon as we knew she was Mary Watson, like as soon as we knew she was marrying, in fact, Watson. And, you know, that's a dead woman walking role. I guess not necessarily, because this is like a interpretation of Sherlock, but like the original ACD Sherlock, Mrs. Watson doesn't live very long.
Sure, but there's always a chance to tell a better story, isn't there?
I suppose. And also, I think I'm glad she couldn't escape her past. I mean, the actual mechanism of her death is pretty absurd, actually, at the end of 4-1, the Six Thatchers. But the idea that she could not get away from her extremely violent past played well with me, emotionally and narratively.
That's definitely a compelling theme. I just feel like it's a much better show with her in it.
Oh, I actually kind of disagree with you on that one.
How so?
Well, I mean, one of the things I enjoy the most about the first two series is how open they left the story for queer interpretations, and Mary's presence really just disrupts that, which is fine. And also, Amanda Abington, I think, acted the shit out of Mary. Like, I think she added a lot to what was on the page for Mary. But like, I like my low-key unspoken queer Holmes and Watson, or Sherlock and John as they're known in this modern version of the story. I prefer them over Mary being in it, or them being like, you know, like a Scooby-Doo gang. I'm not as into that. The three of them.
Well, you know, I'm never going to be about the shipping, but
that's fine.
I get that as a perspective, definitely, but I don't know. There is a whole raft of discourse about the relationship between Holmes and Watson in this show and in every other adaptation, and there is a ton of discourse about whether it's low-key open to queer shipping, or whether it's crass queer baiting, or whether it's just not there, but you can read into it however you like.
They used to leave it more ambiguous, and as they go on, they remove ambiguity in a way that distresses me. I liked it better when it was undeclared.
I can see that. I can definitely see that. I just...
Although that does definitely squarely make it queer baiting to leave it ambiguous. Like...
It does. Well, I suppose the label queerbaiting depends on what sort of intentions you want to interpret into the actions of the showrunners and the writers. And there is also a whole raft of discourse about good old Stephen Moffat. And not quite as much about like, Mark Gatiss, but still.
Yeah, and Moffat tends to be kind of crass. He cheats a little sometimes when he writes, but I mean, we don't have to. I think those complaints about Moffat are pretty well known. I guess what I want to talk about is 4-1. I thought was actually a really solid installment. 4-2, I actually really really loved, like genuinely loved and appreciated as a. I wouldn't call it a standalone, but like it has an excellent you know, villain of the week. And then 4-3 was the single most disappointing television experience I think I have ever
ever had. So there's that.
Oh, yeah, we got the hot takes coming in.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really liked the middle episode.
Yeah.
I'm predisposed to like the episodes where Sherlock is going after terrible rich people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those were fun. And it was great. And Toby Jones was so good.
He was so, so very good at a character who is admittedly a little one note, but the way that he played that kind of put a little more subtlety into it. And then when he kind of dropped that veneer and was just cackling and cackling and cackling and would not stop, it really kind of gives the viewer the same impression that Sherlock has, that the sheer arrogance and security of this man in his arrogance is just driving you mad.
Yeah, and also I was a little nervous about the teeth prosthesis that they made Toby wear, but actually ended up being okay. But what the part I really, really, really loved about Toby Jones's performance was toward the end of the arc, when he's alone in the hospital room with Sherlock, and also the way he enters the room behind the door, which is so creepy, so like directly out of a nightmare. But then, like, he comes over and he wants Sherlock to plead for his life, which is, like, a trope that you sometimes see with, like, a, you know, an arch villain and a hero, you know, something like that. But it's a very soft-spoken interchange, and he has Sherlock plead a couple times, and he says, like, really quietly, that's lovely. And it, like, really highlighted the perversion of it. Like, why was he a serial killer? Was it a power thing? Was it a gain thing? No, like, he was actually gratified by the extinguishing of other lives, like a true pure psychopath. And which also like reflects back on how Sherlock is not a psychopath. Like people call Sherlock a psychopath from time to time in the story, and it's like it was just like a nice drop in into the series. You'd be like, no kids, like what an actual psychopath looks like is this. So,
well, what an actual psychopath looks like is the serial killer from episode 2, and what a psychopath looks like is the big bad of the entire season, apparently. And there's something else that there's possibly a lot to go into as far as the relationship that the show has with, like, actual diagnosable mental illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when Sherlock calls himself a high-functioning sociopath when he kills Rupert Murdoch in series 3.
Yeah.
And then when people are talking about Eros as a psychopath.
Yeah.
But when it comes to Culverton Smith, it's all about control, and it's about power, and it's about not just having that in the business world, but also having that in your hands.
Yeah. And also the intelligence he displayed, making Sherlock's accusation into a joke, like he turns on a dime, like... He doesn't lose any political face at all in the face of Sherlock's, like, accusations. It's just, Sherlock doesn't have power at all. And yes, it turns out he's designed a trap for Culverton Smith, and it's very delightful to watch him fall into it and everything. And I was genuinely nervous for him when they're in the hospital. And there was a lot of artistry in that episode related to the... Who we think is Faith visiting Sherlock, and all the ways in which that character was reminding Sherlock of John. Like when she shows up, she has a cane, and she is walking. Like she's a companion to Sherlock. Like at one point, she uses the word "amazing" to describe one of his deductions, which is something that John does in episode 1 of the entire series. And like, and Sherlock has this one moment of like a really kind of a faraway little smile on his face, and like they don't do a flashback, like they leave it really light. But to me, I was thinking of John, and of course Sherlock is missing John acutely at the beginning of this episode. Like John's furious with him because over Mary's death, which is silly by the way, but anyway, he's missing John at the beginning of the episode, and like this evening that he has with Faith is interesting.
See, that's somewhere else where I kind of fall on the fridging issue with Mary, where she kind of hangs over the narrative for the rest of the series after she dies and hangs around with John literally for a while. And everything that was going on with her and everything that was going on with her dark past and everything that related to her as a character kind of melts away, and she hangs over the narrative for the rest of the series just to inspire a bunch of man pain.
I suppose.
Which I understand is something that's going to happen when the other characters in your show are men.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still, I don't know, it comes across to me as really obnoxious and kind of a waste.
I did like Ghost Mary, though. I guess I liked, John's really good at being haunted. He's been haunted a few different times.
Yeah, and that's something that Martin Freeman can really play. I mean,
no matter what
is going on, Martin Freeman and Bandicoot Cumberbatch are very, very good actors, so much so that it hardly needs to be pointed out anymore. But no matter how disappointing the thing that they're in or the stories that are developing are, they are, God, they're good.
They are. They bring a lot. They do elevate the material that they're given pretty reliably until 4-3, because nothing can elevate it. But I think we're about to get into that. But yeah, they do. They act their dialogue wonderfully. They pick great tones, and then also they do a ton with their faces and body language always, and they just fully embody.
Yeah, even like I said, when the storyline is kind of obnoxious or painful, I get such like secondhand embarrassment or rather secondhand anxiety sometimes with these things. Watson's texting affair with the woman who turned out to be Eurus was just painful to me. Like, whenever any scene relating to that came up, I just wanted to roll my eyes and groan.
Oh, interesting. I actually liked that. Because I think, like, Canon Watson is a womanizer. But I just, like, I don't know, maybe it's because I'm married and I have children, but, like, I really identify with, like, the fantasy of, like, catching a stranger's eye and, like, having, like, a little secret that kind of sustains you when your stress level is really high. I don't know, I found that really identifiable.
That's fair. I hadn't considered it in the context of all of the stress of being a new parent. That's true.
Yeah, like, just those little things of escapism. And also watching him, like, really weigh it. Like, am I going to contact her at all or not? Like, am I saving the number or not? Like, how high will I escalate? And then his decision to pull it, like, before they ever had any contact, like, physical contact, as far as we know. I'm pretty sure not, actually. But, you know, like, he was cheating in his heart, I think is what he would say. And then the part where he doesn't get to, like, he was going to confess that, and then they get called to the scene in the aquarium, and Mary loses her life, so, like, he doesn't get to put his guilt to bed. And I think the pain of that is very, I understand that, too. And, like, does it mean that Mary's death is a fridging so that we can have all that? Maybe. Maybe I just like Watson in pain. Maybe I'm a sadist. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's certainly fair to like Martin Freeman playing pained stoicism.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that he does a whole lot on this show.
Mm.
Also, there's a bit of a visual reference. I don't know if you'd call it a visual gag, where Mary dies, and then a couple scenes later, Mycroft looks balefully into his fridge.
Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, maybe you can explain this, because I don't really know. Why is it that Mycroft appears to work in a prison cell and live in another one? Like, that's just a little detail of the set dressing that really kind of threw me off a couple of times.
Yeah, Mycroft's home life is super weird. That whole scene with the refrigerator is super, super weird. Like, does Mycroft have a takeout menu on his fridge? Like, is that a thing?
Apparently, that the kitchen set was very, very minimalist, and just the concrete walls in his kitchen and in his office both really stood out, because they really looked like prison cells.
I mean, maybe it's like the idea that they're explosion-proof? I have no idea. And, oh, before we get into fucking the final problem, I did want to say I enjoyed what we find out about the therapist John is seeing is not a therapist. The woman he saw on the bus is not who we think she is. Like, there's this reveal, and I wanted them to do something different than what they actually did, because when we see her on the bus, oh, and then we find out also that she was Faith. When we see her on the bus and she's talking to John and approaches John, she has an Irish accent. And like, when we find out she's not who she says she is, and we're in the therapist's house and it's getting all heated, like the idea that this person would have been an agent of Moriarty or related to Moriarty's conspiracy, and that, like, you know, no matter, you know, he continues to be everywhere from beyond the grave. Like, that was really exciting for a second before we find out what they actually did with that. But the idea that, like, actually nobody was casually flirting with you, John, you're a fucking target again because of your association with Sherlock. Like,
yeah, because nothing is allowed to happen to Watson that's unrelated to Sherlock.
Right, and just kind of a constant F you and F your autonomy. But actually, at the same time, it's a callback to the opening of the series when Mycroft approaches John and is like, you know, this is not like a regular person that you're going to start associating yourself with. Like, this is not a regular flat share. I just feel like someone should tell you. Yeah, so should we start with the final problem? Taking it apart, maybe, or...
Oh, goodness.
Oh...
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous vintage wall pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit clotheslines and headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and, Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name, now known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Left Is from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
So, like, up until the final problem, it was like an adventure genre. But then the final problem starts, and suddenly it's Saw on Shutter Island.
See, that's...
What even the fuck?
See, that's one of the things that really jumped out to me about that episode, in stark contrast to the usual structure of a Sherlock episode, even the big finales or the big premieres, which are plentiful when you have three-episode seasons.
Mm-hmm.
You expect a Sherlock plot to be somewhat labyrinthine, right? You expect a lot of narrative alleys where, you know, they're investigating someone and it's not them, and they're investigating someone and it's not them, and, you know, the plot thickens, as they say. And the final problem is just so much more straightforward. A to B to C to D. You're in this room, and we're doing this, and then you go to this room, and we do that, and then you go to the next room, and we do the next thing. We know who did it.
There's no mystery. There's zero mystery, like, about who is responsible for the anguish. Like, there's mystery about things that happened in the past, which I guess is supposed to sustain us, but there's no, like, there's no tension there.
Yeah, and I know that it's a real thing that happens to real children presented with trauma, but narratively, all of Sherlock's revelations of things that happened to him and to people he cared about when he was a small child, and then, you know, Bramble Pelt Cumbersnatch, you know, looks into the middle distance and says, "Now I remember." It just feels cheap.
It is cheap, and it's horribly written. It doesn't do any service to any of the characters. It's just insane what they chose to do. Like, especially, so we met Mr. and Mrs. Holmes in season 3, and, like, is there any way in the universe that they would have Eros confined that way from childhood? Absolutely not. There's no way in the world. And then, if you were going to confine Eros in such a place, like, what even the fuck with the security and security breaches? Like, the first, oh my god, like, how did she escape at all, first of all? Like, how did she ever escape? And I'm not interested in the explanation about the glass. That was nonsense. Oh, yeah, well, it was nonsense.
Well, that's just everything that follows on from her, like, apparent hypnotism superpower or something.
Mind control.
Yeah.
Like, which they never call it mind control, but, like, no, being persuasive to that degree is not a feature of intelligence. Like, I just, whoever wrote it has no that's not a thing. That's not a thing.
It's the TV version.
Like, the people in Sherlock are not soups. Like, were they watching too much Marvel before they wrote this shit? Maybe. Like, that is not a thing.
I don't know about Mark Gatiss, but I'm pretty sure Stephen Moffat hasn't seen a superhero movie since the first Richard Donner Superman, at least going by the Doctor Who Christmas special of recent. Mm-hmm. But anywho, it's very much the TV version of persuasiveness, and it's very much the TV version of the idea, as foreshadowed in the Thatcher episode, when Sherlock says, you know, if you know every variable, then apparently random things would follow from premises that you know. You know, and that is exactly Eros's superpower, I guess. You know, throughout the show, it's almost like a superpower the way that Sherlock and Mycroft interact with the world. That's certainly the way that it's presented in terms of cinematography sometimes. Where
sometimes, but, like, they've given the explanation that Mycroft has a ton of resources. He has a ton of power and a ton of money. And that's how humans achieve powerful things. They don't have actual enhanced ability. Like, and I know that they don't refer to Eurus's thing as an enhanced ability, but the way that they depict it in the show has nothing to do with human abilities. Like, it's just insane. And also, it's so stupid what they say about it. They say Mycroft is introducing her as she's, you know, she's incandescent intelligence and, you know, not seen since Isaac Newton. Like, did they just, like, Google search for genius names? Like, they couldn't come up with somebody more relevant than Isaac Newton or like, more, like, What is that? It's so lazy. I'm offended by it. It's just nonsense. And also they wrote the entire thing they did with Mycroft in the final problem is just a complete disservice to everything else we've seen about Mycroft. Like, it's just every single thing about the episode is garbage. Garbage. Oh, I'm just so angry about it.
I know.
It's so stupid. Like, we could just name all the stupid things. Like, how the fuck did they get to the Holmes estate to do the closing? Hashtag unclear. Like, how does Watson not immediately recognize human bones? He's a doctor. Fuck that. Like, how did they get him out of the well when he was chained to the bottom? Hashtag unclear. Like, it's just, there's so many plot holes.
See, that's the sort of thing that doesn't grate with me that much, because I don't think those plot holes are that hard to fill in. I mean, they got tranquilized and then woke up and had been transported. You know,
How?
On a helicopter, probably.
From where?
From Sharonford to wherever the house is.
Oh my god. Contracted by who? How did she get out? What the...
She has persuasion superpowers.
Yeah.
She told the helicopter pilot to go there and, like... I don't know. Moriarty built the shack. I don't know. See, that's the sort of thing that doesn't stand out as much to me. The things that kind of irk me more about it are the things that are just concentrated on and turn out to be either trite or pointless. Like everything on the airplane with the little girl.
Yes.
Which turns out to be Eurus's mind palace or something. Yes.
Oh my god, they barely bothered to address that, and it was just ridiculous. And like the mystery about the song that she's singing makes no sense. The thing on the gravestones makes no sense. Like, they don't flesh it out. It doesn't make sense. Like, none of these mysteries are in character for previously established mysteries in the way that they're solved. Like, like Sherlock doesn't cheat. That's the entire reason we love Sherlock. Is he can explain in a list how he got from point A to B, and it's usually ridiculous, but like, he has a path and he can explain it to us. There are no paths with any explanations for any of the nonsense that they do in the final problem, and it has nothing to do with the way that they tell stories in Sherlock. It's just crazy instead. And they throw away the Victor Trevor idea that exists from Arthur Conan Doyle. Like, they brought it in and then they crap on it immediately. Like, it's just, they also do not adequately give foundation for Eurus's obsession with Sherlock. We're supposed to somehow figure out from the story that she set Moriarty on his obsessive path with Sherlock, because she is still obsessed with Sherlock and has been since she was a child, and she was horrifyingly jealous of Sherlock's friend. And they don't prepare it.
I think actually Moriarty already knew about Sherlock. I think he mentions him in that scene 5 years ago before he goes to talk to Eurus. Mm-hmm. But she definitely...
Well, she sharpens his focus, I think.
She definitely influences him, yeah. That's another thing that kind of grates about this whole series just past, that they keep bringing Moriarty back again and again and again in various different ways. And they referenced Irene Adler a couple of times. And it's just reminiscent of back when the show was better and had more ideas and people liked it more.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, maybe Laura Pulver isn't available. That's fine. But like, bringing her up for very little reason just reminds me of Scandal in Belgravia, which was an incredible episode of the show.
Yeah, it was wonderful. That one was really strong. It was my favorite for a while.
Ooh, what is now?
Oh, actually, maybe it still is. Although, really, the Reichenbach Fall has so much going on.
Reichenbach was really good. Last Vow, the wedding episode, was really, really good, I thought.
That one was okay. And I actually do really like The Lying Detective. I really do. It's probably my top three now. Yeah.
But
some more nonsense with, Mycroft is such an idiot in this episode. And I actually enjoy the dynamic that they had previously established, that Mycroft is smarter than Sherlock and needles him about it from time to time. But like, Mycroft is even more horrifically socially handicapped than Sherlock. Like, I enjoy that continuum between the two of them. And then Mycroft is such a dumb shit in this episode. It really breaks my heart that he's not allowed to be smart. And, I'm bouncing a little bit, but, I enjoyed the only moment in The Final Problem that I enjoyed at all was seeing that they did have Moriarty and Uros speak. So, and I was excited about the ramifications of that, possibly. I enjoyed seeing him in the office and, like, the idea that Mycroft had met him before. Like, we learn that it's before the events of the series that this happens, this meeting on Sharonford. Because, like, Mycroft is so shitty about his distribution of information to everybody. And, like, this one, which he became ashamed of, is obviously really damaging. So, like, I liked that one little fragment of why Moriarty and Sherlock... Like, Sherlock, of course, would naturally be obsessed with somebody like Moriarty. But, like, how much Mycroft was involved in that. Like... John's always naturally blamed Mycroft for how damaging Moriarty was to Sherlock, and then it's like it's even worse than we thought. So I kind of liked that emotion, sort of. But then they throw it all away again. Like I would have liked it better if Uros and Moriarty were like more of a partnership, and less that like, oh well, Uros put him under her sway because that's what she does. Thing that they kind of hinted at.
Yeah, when I was first watching it, I was about 60% convinced that they were going to go to Sharonford Island and find Moriarty in the prison, too.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I had that thought also. And I also kind of liked there's some famous short story, and I can't remember, and I apologize to everyone for not knowing it, but there's some short story where we find out that actually, and the story is set in a mental hospital, and we later find out that all the quote-unquote doctors are actually the patients, and they've incapacitated all the actual doctors. And so there was a little hint of that and John's kind of discovering, like, who is Uros talking to on this tape. It's like, actually that guy who unfortunately has no agency anymore.
No, not at all.
The lead guard, or whatever you want to call him, the doctor, or the governor, I guess they call him, at the hospital. And then just, like, all of the TikTok nonsense, like, all the little tapes that Moriarty, I guess, made in the 5 minutes that he had with Uros, and then she can use them later. Like, what? So, it's just so cheap. Those little tricks are so cheap.
It's so much of a narrative shortcut, bringing Moriarty back because he's a very important character, because Uros can't stand on her own because there isn't that much that's been invested in her.
Yes, because they randomly created her at obviously the last second. And I know that they want to get credit for being clever by, like, having Mycroft speak cryptically about the East Wind all the time. Like, just fuck that. Like, I don't buy that they had this in view when they started the series, this particular way that it would...
Oh, of course
not. And they also, like, I think they were trying to tell a story full of pathos, like, oh, Sherlock is so messed up because he has PTSD or CPTSD from all this kind of stuff. Like, it's not to be all clinical and stuff, but they don't really go into that, and they have not gone into it before. Like, we hear about Redbeard a little bit in season 3 as Sherlock's beloved dog, and they actually, I honestly think it would have been better if the trauma was that Uros killed the dog. I think that's actually adequate to explain why Sherlock is, like, vaguely and poorly remembering that. Like, losing a pet actually is horrifyingly traumatic when you're a child. They didn't need to do that, and they didn't need to add the murder of a child to Uros's body count, because she already killed hella people.
Yeah, it was like so much more chilling when she killed the governor's wife, because she was a person who was there and was actually in a scene.
Yeah.
Than some child we see for 10 seconds in a flashback.
Yeah, and like she killed the dog and set the house on fire and she was like 7 years old. That's plenty. That's plenty. And also, like, we met the Holmes, like, I'm still mad because we met the Holmes parents and, you know, we learned that Mrs. Holmes is a genius, a math genius, and Mr. Holmes is kind of more regular. And they've raised Mycroft and Sherlock, and it's a bitch to raise gifted children. We know that from society, but like, we also know that like the animal cruelty and like horrible acts of destruction, like they're associated with serious child abuse usually. And like, what is that? Like you can't just throw that in there. I don't know. Like, it does not make any sense. It's disconnected from everything that's been established. Like, I don't know what they were going for other than shock value. And I don't mind being surprised. I like left turns in a story. We have some really good ones in 4-1 and 4-2, actually, where it's like, lol, like when we see the Agra drive again, and Sherlock is super disturbed by it. I actually loved that. And then they go back and explain that there's more than one Agra drive. The one that was thrown in the fire didn't magically reappear somewhere else. There was more than one, which is an actual explanation for why you would see one again after you saw one get burned. And that works and like is physically possible and makes sense, unlike many of the things that we see in the final problem.
Also, I think as a TV show goes on, and it feels weird to say this about Sherlock because this was the 13th episode, but as a show goes on, there's an impulse to explain more and more about the characters, sometimes to excess. Like, Sherlock is withdrawn and socially maladapted and extremely intelligent. I'm not sure that needs a point-by-point origin story, you know?
Yeah, and especially since it's not even a good one. It's not a good one at all. It's just not. Like, you can extrapolate why, like, how being burdened with a genius like Sherlock's would make you an isolated child. Like, you can do that without any of this other shit. There's actually some excellent fan fiction about Sherlock as a child that goes into many different dimensions of how he would come to be how he is that don't have to do with an insane institutionalized sister that his brother's been veiling from him since child. Like, it's just, it does not work. It doesn't work. It doesn't serve the previous material. It just made me feel sick and sad and ripped off and pissed instead of anything positive.
I think at this point I'm kind of done with the asshole genius archetype.
Mm-hmm. We see it a lot.
We see it a lot, and it is so obnoxious.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to a limited degree, you can indulge it, but as you go on and you see it in more and more shows, and especially procedural shows, because it's always a character dynamic you can rerun, it's just tired, I think. You know, eventually you want every other character to just shun him because it's painful to be with him. Like Molly, more than anyone else.
Oh, they really fucked with that, too.
I was kind of more interested in whatever Molly was going through before Eurus called her than I am in anything else that happened in the final problem.
Yeah.
You know, what got her so upset that day?
Actually, yeah, that's an open mystery, isn't it? So, someone on Tumblr pointed out that they really went backwards with Molly. Like, she's very lovesick in the beginning. And then she kind of gets to come into her own a little bit. We see her stand up to Sherlock a little bit more and more. Like, we see her, she's got that boyfriend at some point at their wedding. Like, she's trying to get her life together. And of course, she was a conspirator in the Reichenbach fall.
Mm-hmm.
And successfully kept that secret from Watson. Like, that was a strong, strong move. She's meant to get stronger as a character over time. And then the last we hear from her is just something that demonstrates zero growth from episode one, although she's more sad and angry when she's talking about it. But like, the idea that her love for Sherlock is humiliating is something they already talked about, and like, they make him sit in it. And I guess like, part of it is like a torture for Sherlock because he's developed, so now he gets that's humiliating, I guess. So that makes it more like about him than about her. And like, the coffin was super ridiculous. Like, why was that there? What are you talking about? and like the way they explain the deductions that he puts forth to figure out that it's Molly are just, there's just really thin. It's just really thin. And I also think like a coffin for a woman who's about 5'4" who loves Sherlock could just as easily have been Irene Adler as it could have been Molly.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what Watson says. And Sherlock just kind of brushes it off.
I actually think it maybe should have been Irene Adler rather than Molly. If they were going to even sit in that at all, and it was just ridiculous.
Yeah, I really wonder if that was an issue of availability for the actress.
I read somewhere in some discussion of it that scene was an add-on. They used it to replace something that they all hated worse than that. So I can't even imagine what that would have been.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. That it was kind of like an added in thing. And maybe that does again suggest that they couldn't find Laura Palmer. Too bad, because she was great. and I like her being an agent of Moriarty. Like, I like it better when Moriarty is still the one in control. And like, if they were going to bring him in to something called The Final Problem, I would have liked a more strong relationship with the ACD story. Which, and I guess they felt like they couldn't go there because they used the story of The Final Problem in The Reichenbach Fall.
They used it in Reichenbach Fall. They used part of it again in Abominable Bride. So I don't know how many times they can adapt it.
Yeah, I mean, there's dozens of Sherlock stories, and there's only a handful that are like, you know, very popular, and continue to be pop culture reference points even now, 100 years later. More than 100 years later. I don't know. I wish they had wanted it to be good. I just don't. And also, I'm so pissed. Like, why does Mary get to be the one who does this weird, like, ABC family, don't worry, everyone, it's all going to be fine. Like, they're going to go back to 221B. By the way, they destroyed 221B with an absurd grenade that allegedly was from Euros. Like, what even is that? That's nuts. Like, that was stupid too. Anyway,
what was nuts about that?
Vaporized 221B.
What was nuts about that scene was that the drone flies in with the grenade, and Army Man John Watson doesn't know what a grenade is, and Sherlock doesn't know what a grenade is, and they have to ask Mycroft to explain to them what a grenade is.
It was a special grenade.
I get that it was a special grenade, but you look at a thing that is shaped like a grenade and which is threatening you, and the guy who was in the fucking army doesn't know what it is.
Yeah.
No, because one of the smart characters has to explain it to him.
It was real dumb shit. Oh, that does, although thinking about 221B and the explosion, it reminds me of how much I enjoyed Mrs. Hudson in episode 2, where she's like, she has her fancy-ass car and she ended up dragging Sherlock to John's therapy appointment in the fucking trunk, and she reminds Watson that she's the widow of a drug dealer, so of course she can have a nice car, like, and of course she can own property in central London, like.
Yeah, Mrs. Hudson rules.
Yeah, she ruled really hard in that scene, and like there were those jokes about how predictive Sherlock can actually be, and John and you know John is so pissed about it, and then it was like you figured out where I would be, and like the ghost of Mary like explains like how Sherlock would be able to figure out where John was exactly, and then like the haha like he didn't predict that Hutters would throw him in the fucking trunk of the car though. Like, That joke I actually enjoyed. I think it might have been the last time I laughed in the Sherlock series, because I did not crack even a smile in the entire Final Problem. And like, I don't have a problem with dark content. Like, the Reichenbach Fall is actually super, super, super dark. But I love that one. It's not, like, it doesn't have to make me laugh. That's not actually the problem. The utter logical fails are a problem. The choice to switch genres to horror is a problem. All of the ways in which they break the rules of physics and time are a problem. All the ways they broke character were a problem. All the ways that they give Eros a bunch of power and then take it away again when she's just a sad little girl alone on a crashing plane, hashtag what? That's a problem. The whole thing is a problem. They don't even have the music. Like, our little adventure song can't even squeeze in because it's too dark and fucked up.
Yes, but which of these problems is the final one?
That might be a good place to do the cut, the clapboard.
But
yeah, for real. So I guess it's like RIP, my love of Sherlock. I enjoyed you. I'm kind of ignoring it, I guess.
Do you think you'll come back when they make more?
I heard they were going to make more. Why?
I kind of hope they don't for a long time. Just get some more ideas first.
I talked to the Tumblr about my sadness, and the prevailing theory that has any merit at all is that the final problem is a coma nightmare of John's.
Oh, come on!
Yeah, and I actually see how they could recover from that, because I do actually think that they artfully insert, like, the way that the dream idea functions in Abominable Bride is actually pretty good. It holds up pretty well. And then the way they flow it into Sherlock being high as balls in his debriefing with MI6 at the very beginning of 4-1, I enjoyed that. So there is maybe a way that they can do it. Maybe they can just lock Moffat like in a trunk instead of letting him write even a single word for season 5, if they even do one.
See,
but I don't know if they have enough money to afford Benedict and Martin anymore.
I'm pretty sure they do it for a lower rate than they could get when they're between movies, just for fun at this point. Because both of their...
Was there anything fun about the final problem, though? I have to only imagine that shooting the final problem was fucking excruciating. God.
See, I don't know. I'm sure they had fun together. You know, being together all the time.
Also, the effects work in the 221B explosion was really bad.
That was a little insufficient, yeah.
Like, don't do that if it's gonna look like that. Like, it's 2017, you can't... That doesn't hack it anymore. It's... Nope. That doesn't work. Yeah, so, like, is the final problem a nightmare of John's? And like, is it a cult, like, the East Wind thing? Like, the idea of Eros? Like, did John at one point study Latin when he was in medical school? Or is it Greek? It might be Greek.
Greek, yeah.
Yeah, and, like, that one time when he's being taunted on the tarmac when Sherlock is flying away at the end of, I guess it's his last vow, episode 3-3, about how there's an east wind and this whole shit. And so, like, it's like that little chunk is in his brain. And then he dreams this entire shit. Maybe they will use Eros more the way that I wish her to be used. Is she a compatriot of Moriarty? Literally, like, I don't know. What even?
That sounds so bad.
Also, I didn't like Eros. I didn't like Eros being in a nightgown. I didn't like her having hair like the girl from The Ring. I didn't like anything about it.
I know that real deal sociopaths and psychopaths are able to kind of fake more typical emotional lives. And that's why you don't always know if someone is a sociopath, technically. But Eros seemed to kind of swing from, like, not knowing, like, what am emotions? Oh, I got the wrong one. And then she was able to so seamlessly have her texting affair with John and be his therapist.
Yeah.
You know, which would involve quite a lot of discussions about emotions, you'd think.
Yeah, and, like, what does it mean to be crazy? Like, that, it's a very under-considered and stuck in tropes for her to have, like, a child's voice and, like...
Yeah, the...
She has tics and stuff. Like, she has some tics, but then suddenly she doesn't. Like, either she's at a high level of impairment or she's not. Like, you have to choose a vector. And they just don't. They just do whatever they want instead, and it holds no water at all.
It's very much a TV show intersection with mental illness, and always has been on Sherlock, really.
Yeah, they use it pretty cheap most of the time.
I mean, I'm coming at it right now from a less forgiving viewpoint, because I just saw Split the other day.
I don't know that one.
The theatrical feature film about James McAvoy playing a person with dissociative identity disorder who abducts some girls.
Okay.
Which, I'm not going to go into spoilers for that, so don't worry, dear listener, but there are a whole bunch of... There's a whole avenue to go down with the movie mental illness thing, and all of the various shades in that movie. And in Sherlock, it's always been kind of a superficial TV show view of sociopathy and psychopathy that you find in a lot of crime shows as well.
It falls into the way in which neurotypical people will use the idea of pathology for entertainment when it's actually not particularly funny, and it's not, like, it's tourism to be a bunch of people who don't have mental illness writing about and depicting and considering people allegedly with mental illness with, like, no consultation of people who are mental, like, you know what, it's just, it's not very sympathetic, and it's frankly fairly dehumanizing to approach it in the way that they do.
Definitely at times, yeah. But overall, the impression I come away with from this series is just that Moffat and Gatiss don't appear to have a whole lot of ideas. You know, they keep returning to Moriarty over and over, and they keep throwing in Irene Adler references as a little spice so much. And the progression isn't really there. I mean, I get that you want the resolution of the big overarching Sherlock story to be about the emotionally repressed and maladjusted Sherlock finding an emotional solution to a case, right? You know, he eventually does intuit that what Eros really needs is a hug. Except that comes in the form of presenting Eros as really just needing a hug. And so there's an impression that I get that they just don't have new ideas on where to go with this thing, which
is so stupid since they have literally volumes of source material. Fucking read it more then. Like, what are you doing over there?
And I know, I mean, they know the source material. They throw in Easter eggs all the ding-dang time. But in terms of what they're doing,
I mean, the ACD really struggled to finish Sherlock 2. Like, it sounds hard to kill your Frankenstein, I guess.
Right, well, I mean, as we're drawing to a close on Stephen Moffat's time on Doctor Who, and possibly Mark Gatiss's as well, because since he's Moffat's best friend, he gets to write an episode every year, and they're not good, usually. Just the lack of ideas, combined with the recent Doctor Who Christmas special that I was not impressed with particularly, just does not leave me looking forward to the next series of Doctor Who, sadly. I mean, I won't go into it a whole lot of detail, because, Alana, I know you're not an avid watcher of the show, but one of the things that Moffat does on Doctor Who all the time is when a cast member is going to be leaving the show, he'll do stories where they could possibly leave, and then they don't. It's like he's rehearsing it several times. When Karen Gillan was going to leave the show, there were a few times where, you know, the Doctor would drop her off at a house and she would be gone for an episode or two. Or something would happen that might presage her leaving the show, and then she wouldn't. And then eventually she did. And when you're coming up to the time when, as a viewer of the show, you know, cast members leaving the show, this is actually it this time, you think, okay, Moffat and the other writers have rehearsed it in this way and this way and this way. When they actually do it, they've got to have a better idea than all those rehearsals, right? And the same thing happened at the end of the 2015 series of Doctor Who, when another cast member was leaving the show and had rehearsed it so many times in so many different ways that you think, what the hell is it going to be this time? And it turned out to be wonderful. The last three episodes of Series 9 of Doctor Who, I thought, were so good and handled that departure so well. Told a better story than those rehearsals, and functioned in a way as a rehearsal for Stephen Moffat leaving the show. You know, there are all sorts of things. I don't know when he thought he was leaving or thought he could be leaving after that series or the Christmas special following that, or whatever, before he got signed on, because the next showrunner won't be available until 2018, so he's doing one more series. And so there's that tension right now as well.
Uh-huh.
Like, we know this is Moffat's last series, probably with the Christmas special after that at the end of the year as well, but Series 9 would have been such a good ending for his tenure on the show. And uh-huh. even the Christmas special following that would have been a good ending for his tenure on the show. And now, with the most recent Christmas special and this most recent series of Sherlock, in which there aren't a lot of new ideas on how to move forward, I really, really hope that he has something good up his sleeve for his actual departure from Doctor Who, and I have no idea if he does.
He probably doesn't, dude.
Yeah, maybe.
He's not a long-term planner. Like, he's not... He hasn't done that for us or himself.
Quite possibly. But, I mean, we'll see, I guess.
Yeah.
And there's always... The fan dynamic with Moffat just drives me batty sometimes. Because that's one of those areas where I don't like him quite as much as his avid defenders... And I don't hate him as much as his haters, because a lot of his haters, I think, hate him for bad reasons. But there are also good reasons to be dissatisfied with some of his work. So it's complicated, but man, I hope he's got something good.
Okay, let's put a more optimistic spin on it. It'll be great, and...
I actually read when I
and
was...
And that's why, and he's been working on it this whole time, and Sherlock was so shitty because he was busy making Doctor Who wonderful.
Well, oh god. Series 6 of Doctor Who suffered in the extreme because Moffat's schedule in particular was packed, and he was trying to make Sherlock, and that year of Doctor Who, they did a long mid-season break, and even after that, they were essentially filming all of his first drafts. So that didn't go well. So when he's really, really busy and making two shows at the same time, it's not a great track record, although Sherlock was great that year, in any event. I did actually read today, when I was looking around in a couple of places, that apparently, at the same time that they plotted out the framing structure of Series 4, they actually plotted out Series 5 a little bit, too.
I know. Okay.
I have no idea if or when they'll wind up making it, but there's that.
Oh man. I mean, will I watch it if it shows up? Of course I will. Probably, depending on how 5-1 looks.
depending on how busy your life is?
It depends on what they do in 5-1, I guess. Or I probably will finish it. I have compulsion to complete pretty badly about most things. Even things that betray me. Like Dexter comes to mind as a show that went off the rails and broke my heart. But then, like, maybe it was kind of okay at the very last second. And then, Weeds also was a show that went pretty far off the rails and then sort of vaguely came back. But it's hard to know when to kill something that's successful. I appreciate the challenge of that, but it makes me, especially, I guess, I'm spoiled now that we're in the era of the streaming-produced... miniseries, because you get amazing content like our friend Stranger Things, which was clearly plotted from head to toe before, and you know, Sherlock comes from a different time. Like, if the mechanism of producing Sherlock is quite different, and the time that they have had to sustain between production cycles is much different, and all those challenges, and I can respect those challenges. It's just the idea that they seem to have had no end game, and they gave us this is just wow. Although I suppose 5 really is going to happen, and that makes the final problem not the actual series finale.
And yet it feels like it at the end too. It's like a total reset. you know, there's no more Mary. They have the baby, but apparently they can, you know, drop her off whenever. And oh God. And Mary comes back again from beyond the grave to deliver
this... With a different DVD.
Yeah, to deliver a trite little monologue about no matter what happens, there'll always be my Baker Street boys.
It was so insufferable.
Oh, God.
It reminds me of something that you might hear if you went to, like, the Sherlock Museum of Culture and, like, you got one of those little tapes with the headphones and, like, a docent... you know, like a docent's voice talks to you about everything that you're looking at. It was like that. It was so weird. Or like it was like an in memoriam reel for Sherlock and John. Like just the tone of the speech and the way it's delivered is so fucking weird. And not even like Mary. She doesn't even sound like Mary. It's just weird. It's just such a mistake. Like there's just every single instinct that they had with the final problem was wrong.
Quite. And on that note.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Put it out of its misery. Put me out of my misery.
Oh. All right. And on that note, I think we are going to draw to a close tonight. Alana, thank you so much for coming back on the show to talk about this. Is there any place online where you would like to point our listeners?
Oh, I'm in a little bit of a Facebook sabbatical because of grad school, but if people would like to talk to me, you can use Messenger to reach me at Alana Jane. And let's see, where am I hanging out on the internet? I've been rediscovering how wonderful Tumblr is and how you can search very specific tags and become instantly gratified. And maybe I just want to encourage people to follow content about Mads Mikkelsen because he's really sexy and interesting.
Quite.
This is kind of a random recommendation, but there you have it.
All right. And if anyone would like to contact me, leave comments about the show, and leave it on the post for this episode on the Place to Be Nation Facebook page. You can find me on Twitter or Tumblr at Glennie Bunn, or email me if you would really like to. Glenn B with two N's at placetobenation.com if you have questions, comments, suggestions for the show. If there's any topic you want us to cover, that's, you know, we'll always take it under consideration. And thank you, Alana, for being here again, and thank you, listeners, for being with us. We'll be coming back soon. We will have our second annual Oscar preview for the Best Original Score category, because that was a blockbuster episode for us last year. We're going to do that again. And we will be back as time and subjects permit. So thank you very much, and good night. So, did you ever look up Sherlock on Tumblr or Twitter or anywhere?
Yeah.
Did you see... Oh, my God. After I caught up with the show, I was looking around and all I saw was the episode 4 shit.
The episode 4 bit?
You didn't see any of that?
I guess not. What are you talking about?
There were whole swaths of people convinced that there was a secret 4th episode to the series.
Oh, weird.
That was going to air a week after The Final Problem. And then, when it didn't, some of them decided that, oh no, it's going to air on January 28th, because that's the anniversary of when Sherlock and John first met, or something. Maybe the 29th, whatever. Or maybe it'll air in March, because there's some other significant anniversary in the Sherlock Holmes canon in March. so like obsessed with the idea that one, there's a secret fourth episode coming, and two, that secret fourth episode is where John and Sherlock are finally going to kiss.
Oh, yeah, so the part of that I did see is the John Locke conspiracy people. I run into them all the time on Tumblr, and that's the people who think there's no way on earth that the show would not end in them being a couple.
And it's
even
like,
though and Moftis has completely denied that will ever happen, and I believe them.
No, they have no interest in doing a queer love story. Just like they have no interest in Sherlock being asexual, because that's not their deal. That's not what they're doing. And by all means, ship your ships. And mm-hmm. I agree that there need to be more shows with queer representation. Absolutely, but like, obsessing so narrowly on John Locke, and honestly, it seems like a lot of the people who are most invested in John Locke are a certain subset of straight folks.
Oh yes,
which feels a little bit uncomfortable.
Yeah,
it's just I don't get it. I mean, ship your ships, but I don't get the like monomania about it's going to be canon. It's going to be canon. They're going to do it. It's going to be canon. Like, no, sorry.
It's not. Yeah. Like, on one hand, like, I kind of feel like folks are grieving and they're in the denial and bargaining stages to think that there's going to be a fourth episode.
Like, seriously, the idea that there's some secret fourth episode. And people say that, you know, well, they have unannounced prologues that came out before Series 3 and, you know, in Doctor Who a couple of times. And, like, yeah, that was before the episodes that were announced to drum up interest. Like, if you wanted to drive ratings down as much as possible, I suppose you would announce that you're airing some other show no one cares about and then show an episode of Sherlock instead. But, like, even aside from the commercial considerations, which I suppose are a little complicated at the BBC,
yeah,
the motives behind a secret fourth episode from the perspective of, like, TV producers and stuff doesn't make any damn sense. It was just annoying.
Oh, yeah. Also, you make a good point. What does it mean that all the John Locke conspiracists, almost all of them, solidly 90% of them are women, and a lot of them are straight women? That is really weird, isn't it?
There's a long, long history of shipping and fanfic and all that being an area where women could, like, explore sexuality a little more than the cultures they live in let them. Certainly that was a big reason why so much of the Kirk Spock slash that invented quote unquote slash was written by women doing fanzines in the 70s. So, I mean, there's a long history of that in fandom, but like I said, sometimes it does get a little uncomfortable.
I respect your take on it as a queer guy.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I get a little nervous about taking that mantle on sometimes too, because I'm not like super obviously stereotypically queer. So it's, I don't know, kind of feels like stealth queer sometimes.
You have.
Yeah. I guess
it's fine. It's something it's good to acknowledge.
Yeah, it gets complicated, you know, where there's a certain passing privilege sometimes in bisexuality or pansexuality, but there's also the conflation of that sort of passing with, there's the idea that that's tantamount to straight privilege, that some monosexual queer people used to kind of minimize and dismiss bi and pan people. It gets so, so complicated.
I mean, we're humans, so anything we can throw in a hierarchy and punish each other for, we will.
Yeah, basically.
That's apparently part of human nature that we can't shake. Why?